Chapter 2. The rigging and the working of the ship, or of her getting some hurt or other. He used to look at her and touch her, as if she was something precious to him. He was always solicitous about her not injuring her health, and constantly entreated her mother to be careful of it. This was so much the more curious, because the child did not like him, but used to shrink away from him, and would not even put out her hand to him without coaxing from others. I believe that every soul on board frequently noticed this, and not one of us understood it. However, it was such a plain fact, that John Steadiman said more than once, when old Mr. Rarks was not within earshot, that if the Golden Mary felt a tenderness for the dear old gentleman she carried in her lap, she must be bitterly jealous of the Golden Lucy. Before I go any further with this narrative, I will state that our ship was a bark of 300 tons, carrying a crew of 18 men, a second mate in addition to John, a carpenter, an armorer or smith, and two apprentices, one a Scotch boy. Poor little fellow, we had three boats. The long boat, capable of carrying 25 men, the cutter, capable of carrying 15, and the surf boat, capable of carrying 10. I put down the capacity of these boats according to the numbers they were really meant to hold. We had tastes of bad weather and head winds, of course, but, on the whole, we had as fine a run as any reasonable man could expect, for 60 days. I then began to enter two remarks in the ship's log, and in my journal. First, that there was an unusual and amazing quantity of ice. Second, that the nights were most wonderfully dark, in spite of the ice. For 5 days and a half, it seemed quite useless and hopeless to alter the ship's course so as to stand out of the way of this ice. I made what southing I could, but, all that time, we were beset by it. Mrs. Atherfield, after standing by me on deck once, looking for some time in an odd manner at the great bergs that surrounded us, said in a whisper, "Oh, Captain Ravender, it looks as if the whole solid earth had changed into ice, and broken up." I said to her, laughing, "I don't wonder that it does, to your inexperienced eyes, my dear." But I had never seen a 20th part of the quantity, and, in reality, I was pretty much of her opinion. However, at 2 p.m. on the afternoon of the 6th day, that is to say, when we were 66 days out, John Steadiman, who had gone aloft, sang out from the top that the sea was clear ahead. Before 4 p.m. a strong breeze springing up right astern, we were in open water at sunset. The breeze then freshening into half a gale of wind, and the Golden Mary being a very fast sailer, we went before the wind merrily, all night. I had thought it impossible that it could be darker than it had been, until the sun, moon, and stars should fall out of the heavens, and time should be destroyed. But, it had been next to light, in comparison with what it was now. The darkness was so profound, that looking into it was painful and oppressive like looking, without a ray of light, into a dense black bandage put as close before the eyes as it could be, without touching them. I doubled the lookout, and John and I stood in the bow side by side, never leaving it all night. Yet I should no more have known that he was near me when he was silent, without putting out my arm and touching him, than I should if he had turned in and been fast asleep below. We were not so much looking out, all of us, as listening to the utmost, both with our eyes and ears. Next day, I found that the mercury in the barometer, which had risen steadily since we cleared the ice, remained steady. I had had very good observations, with now and then the interruption of a day or so, since our departure. I got the sun at noon, and found that we were in lat. 58 degrees S, long. 60 degrees W off New South Shetland, in the neighborhood of Cape Horn. We were 67 days out, that day. The ship's reckoning was accurately worked and made up. The ship did her duty admirably, all on board were well, and all hands were as smart, efficient, and contented, as it was possible to be. When the night came on again as dark as before, it was the 8th night I had been on deck. Nor had I taken more than a very little sleep in the daytime, my station being always near the helm, and often at it, while we were among the ice. Few but those who have tried it can imagine the difficulty and pain of only keeping the eyes open, physically open under such circumstances, in such darkness. They get struck by the darkness, and blinded by the darkness. They make patterns in it, and they flash in it, as if they had gone out of your head to look at you. On the turn of midnight, John Steedyman, who was alert and fresh, for I had always made him turn in by day, said to me, "Captain Ravender, I entreat of you to go below. I am sure you can hardly stand, and your voice is getting weak, sir. Go below, and take a little rest. I'll call you, if a block chafes." I said to John in answer, "Well, well, John, let us wait till the turn of 1 o'clock, before we talk about that." I had just had one of the ship's lanterns held up, that I might see how the night went by my watch, and it was then 12:20. At 1:05, John sang out to the boy, to bring the lantern again, and when I told him once more what the time was, entreated and prayed of me to go below. "Captain Ravender," says he, "all's well. We can't afford to have you laid up for a single hour, and I respectfully and earnestly beg of you to go below." The end of it was, that I agreed to do so, on the understanding, that if I failed to come up of my own accord within 3 hours, I was to be punctually called. Having settled that, I left John in charge. But I called him to me once afterwards, to ask him a question. I had been to look at the barometer, and had seen the mercury still perfectly steady, and had come up the companion again, to take a last look about me, if I can use such a word in reference to such darkness, when I thought that the waves, as the Golden Mary parted them, and shook them off, had a hollow sound in them, something that I fancied, was a rather unusual reverberation. I was standing by the quarter-deck rail on the starboard side, when I called John aft to me, and bade him listen. He did so with the greatest attention. Turning to me he then said, "Rely upon it, Captain Ravender, you have been without rest too long, and the novelty is only in the state of your sense of hearing." I thought so too by that time, and I think so now, though I can never know for absolute certain in this world, whether it was or not. When I left John Steedyman in charge, the ship was still going at a great rate through the water. The wind still blew right astern. Though she was making great way, she was under shortened sail, and had no more than she could easily carry. All was snug, and nothing complained. There was a pretty sea running, but not a very high sea neither, nor at all a confused one. I turned in, as we seamen say, all standing. The meaning of that is, I did not pull my clothes off, no, not even so much as my coat. Though I did my shoes, for my feet were badly swelled with the deck. There was a little swing lamp alight in my cabin. I thought, as I looked at it, before shutting my eyes, that I was so tired of darkness, and troubled by darkness, that I could have gone to sleep best in the midst of a million of flaming gas lights. That was the last thought I had, before I went off, except the prevailing thought that I should not be able to get to sleep at all. I dreamed that I was back at Penrith again, and was trying to get round the church, which had altered its shape very much since I last saw it, and was cloven all down the middle of the steeple in a most singular manner. Why I wanted to get round the church I don't know, but I was as anxious to do it as if my life depended on it. Indeed, I believe it did in the dream. For all that, I could not get round the church. I was still trying, when I came against it with a violent shock, and was flung out of my cot against the ship's side. Shrieks and a terrific outcry struck me far harder than the bruising timbers, and amidst sounds of grinding and crashing, and a heavy rushing and breaking of water sounds I understood too well I made my way on deck. It was not an easy thing to do, for the ship heeled over frightfully, and was beating in a furious manner. I could not see the men as I went forward, but I could hear that they were hauling in sail, in disorder. I had my trumpet in my hand, and, after directing and encouraging them in this till it was done, I hailed first John Steadyman, and then my second mate, Mr. William Rames. Both answered clearly and steadily. Now, I had practiced them, and all my crew, as I have ever made it a custom, to practice all who sail with me, to take certain stations and wait my orders, in case of any unexpected crisis. When my voice was heard hailing, and their voices were heard answering, I was aware, through all the noises of the ship and sea, and all the crying of the passengers below, that there was a pause. Are you ready, Rames?
Sir.
Then light up, for God's sake. In a moment he and another were burning blue lights, and the ship and all on board seemed to be enclosed in a mist of light, under a great black dome. The light shone up so high, that I could see the huge iceberg upon which we had struck, cloven at the top, and down the middle, exactly like Penrith Church in my dream. At the same moment I could see the watch last relieved, crowding up and down on deck. I could see Mrs. Atherfield and Miss Collishaw thrown about on the top of the companion as they struggled to bring the child up from below. I could see that the masts were going with the shock and the beating of the ship. I could see the frightful breech stove in on the starboard side, half the length of the vessel, and the sheathing and timbers spurting up. I could see that the cutter was disabled, in a wreck of broken fragments. And I could see every eye turned upon me. It is my belief that if there had been 10,000 eyes there, I should have seen them all, with their different looks. And all this in a moment. But you must consider what a moment. I saw the men, as they looked at me, fall towards their appointed stations, like good men and true. If she had not righted, they could have done very little there or anywhere but die, not that it is little for a man. To die at his post, I mean they could have done nothing to save the passengers and themselves. Happily, however, the violence of the shock with which we had so determinedly borne down direct on that fatal iceberg, as if it had been our destination instead of our destruction, had so smashed and pounded the ship that she got off in the same instant and righted. I did not want the carpenter to tell me she was filling and going down. I could see and hear that. I gave Rames the word to lower the longboat and the surf boat, and I myself told off the men for each duty. Not one hung back or came before the other. I now whispered to John Steadyman, John, I stand at the gangway here to see every soul on board safe over the side. You shall have the next post of honor, and shall be the last but one to leave the ship. Bring up the passengers, and range them behind me, and put what provision and water you can get at in the boats. Cast your eye forward, John, and you will see you have not a moment to lose. My noble fellows got the boats over the side as orderly as I ever saw boats lowered with any sea running, and, when they were launched, two or three of the nearest men, in them as they held on, rising and falling with the swell, called out, looking up at me, Captain Ravender, if anything goes wrong with us, and you are saved, remember we stood by you. We'll all stand by one another ashore, yet, please God, my lads. Says one, hold on bravely, and be tender with the women. The women were an example to us. They trembled very much, but they were quiet and perfectly collected. Kiss me, Captain Ravender, says Mrs. Atherfield, and God in heaven bless you, you good man. My dear, says I, those words are better for me than a lifeboat. I held her child in my arms till she was in the boat, and then kissed the child, and handed her safe down. I now said to the people in her, you have got your freight, my lads, all but me, and I am not coming yet a while. Pull away from the ship, and keep off. That was the long boat. Old Mr. Arks was one of her complement, and he was the only passenger who had greatly misbehaved since the ship struck. Others had been a little wild, which was not to be wondered at, and not very blamable, but he had made a lamentation and uproar which it was dangerous for the people to hear, as there is always contagion in weakness and selfishness. His incessant cry had been that he must not be separated from the child, that he couldn't see the child, and that he and the child must go together. He had even tried to wrest the child out of my arms, that he might keep her in his. "Mr. Arks," said I to him, "when it came to that, I have a loaded pistol in my pocket, and if you don't stand out of the gangway, and keep perfectly quiet, I shall shoot you through the heart, if you have got one." Says he, "You won't do murder, Captain Ravender." "No, sir," says I won't murder 44 people to humor you, but I'll shoot you to save them." After that he was quiet, and stood shivering a little way off, until I named him to go over the side. The longboat being cast off, the surf boat was soon filled. There only remained aboard the Golden Mary, John Mullion, the man who had kept on burning the blue lights, and who had lighted every new one and every old one before it went out, as quietly as if he had been at an illumination, John Steadyman, and myself. I hurried those two into the surf boat, called to them to keep off, and waited with a grateful and relieved heart for the longboat to come and take me in, if she could. I looked at my watch, and it showed me, by the blue light, 2:10. They lost no time. As soon as she was near enough, I swung myself into her, and called to the men, with a will, "Lads, she's reeling." We were not an inch too far out of the inner vortex of her going down, when, by the blue light which John Mullion still burned in the bow of the surf boat, we saw her lurch, and plunge to the bottom head foremost. The child cried, weeping wildly, "Oh, the dear Golden Mary! Oh, look at her! Save her! Save the poor Golden Mary!" And then the light burned out, and the black dome seemed to come down upon us. I suppose if we had all stood atop of a mountain, and seen the whole remainder of the world sink away from under us, we could hardly have felt more shocked and solitary than we did, when we knew we were alone on the wide ocean, and that the beautiful ship in which most of us had been securely asleep within half an hour was gone forever. There was an awful silence in our boat, and such a kind of palsy on the rowers, and the man at the rudder, that I felt they were scarcely keeping her before the sea. I spoke out then, and said, "Let everyone here thank the Lord for our preservation." All the voices answered, even the child's, "We thank the Lord." I then said the Lord's Prayer, and all hands said it after me with a solemn murmuring. Then I gave the word, "Cheerily, O men, cheerily," and I felt that they were handling the boat again as a boat ought to be handled. The surf boat now burned another blue light to show us where they were, and we made for her, and laid ourselves as nearly alongside of her as we dared. I had always kept my boats with a coil, or two of good stout stuff in each of them, so both boats had a rope at hand. We made a shift, with much labor and trouble, to get near enough to one another to divide the blue lights. They were no use after that night, for the sea water soon got at them, and to get a tow rope out between us. All night long we kept together, sometimes obliged to cast off the rope, and sometimes getting it out again, and all of us wearying for the morning which appeared, so long in coming, that old Mr. Arks screamed out, in spite of his fears of me, "The world is drawing to an end, and the sun will never rise any more." When the day broke, I found that we were all huddled together in a miserable manner. We were deep in the water, being, as I found on mustering, 31 in number, or at least 6 too many. In the surf boat they were 14 in number, being at least 4 too many. The first thing I did, was to get myself passed to the rudder which I took from that time, and to get Mrs. Atherfield, her child, and Miss Collishaw, passed on to sit next me. As to old Mr. Arks, I put him in the bow, as far from us as I could. And I put some of the best men near us in order that, if I should drop, there might be a skillful hand ready to take the helm. The sea moderating as the sun came up, though the sky was cloudy and wild, we spoke the other boat, to know what stores they had, and to overhaul what we had. I had a compass in my pocket, a small telescope, a double-barreled pistol, a knife, and a firebox and matches. Most of my men had knives, and some had a little tobacco. Some, a pipe as well. We had a mug among us, and an iron spoon. As to provisions, there were in my boat 2 bags of biscuit, 1 piece of raw beef, 1 piece of raw pork, a bag of coffee, roasted but not ground, thrown in, I imagine, by mistake, for something else, 2 small casks of water, and about 1/2 gallon of rum in a keg. The surf boat, having rather more rum than we, and fewer to drink it. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.